Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. It's no secret that women are still way underrepresented in the tech field. But why? Google engineer James Damore's name has been all over the national headlines this week after he got fired for sending out an internal memo critiquing the diversity policies designed to even the playing field at the company. He's become a darling of the alt-right in the process, seen as a victim of political correctness for getting fired for expressing opinions unpopular in Silicon Valley. With us now to discuss the contentious 10-page manifesto and the underlying issue of diversity in tech are Louise Metsakis, assistant editor at Vice Media's motherboard site, and Joelle Emerson, founder and CEO of Paradigm, a diversity consulting company. Joelle is also a former women's rights lawyer. Louise, Joelle, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And listeners, who's read the Damore memo and wants to weigh in on why women are underrepresented in the tech industry, on where the limits of corporate free speech should be, denounce rather than fire him? Some say, when does something like this go beyond personal opinion into creating a hostile work environment? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Are there any women in tech jobs or who are or have been with tech companies in the past listening right now who have something to say? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So by way of background, traditionally male-dominated fields like finance and biology are seeing more women, obviously not equal numbers of men and women, but tech seems to remain even more of a boys' club. Business Insider cites that the industry is less than 35% female. So, Joelle, I know you work with data. Are the numbers stubbornly lower for women in tech than other traditionally male fields?
They are, and I think it's particularly interesting that you mentioned biology, because there's research that actually compares STEM fields and looks at why have some STEM fields seen an increase in representation of women while others haven't. And what the research shows is that it's culture. It's perceptions of culture that are transmitted to children and students that consider entering fields, and then it's the culture that persists once people are there and that leads to the high attrition rates that we see where women are leaving the tech industry at twice the rate of men. So while other even STEM fields, even scientific fields, have done a much better job of creating cultures where people from all backgrounds can be successful, can thrive, tech has really failed on that front.
And not only are there low numbers of women in the tech world to start with, but the ones that do make it often wind up leaving. Do you have some stats on that, Joelle?
Yeah, so I think that the main stat is the one that I mentioned, where women are leaving the tech sector at more than twice the rate of men,
yeah.
Really driven by this cultural problem. And I think it's really the industry's culture that drives women out. It also makes it hard for other folks like Black and Latinx people to get in. And then it sends a message to people from backgrounds that are underrepresented in tech, women, people of color, that this isn't going to be a place where they can be successful or where they'll belong. And so I think it's really that culture that's limiting us from building a more diverse tech sector sort of across the pipeline.
So Louise, let me read a little bit or a few little bits of the Damore memo and dig into it with you. He starts by saying, "I value diversity and inclusion, am not denying that sexism exists, and don't endorse using stereotypes." But then he says, "When addressing the gap in representation in the population, we need to look at population level differences in distributions. If we can't have an honest discussion about this, then we can never truly solve the problem." So he identifies some of the problems as this. Google's political bias has equated the freedom from offense with psychological safety, but shaming into silence is the antithesis of psychological safety. This silencing has created an ideological echo chamber where some ideas are too sacred to be honestly discussed. The lack of discussion fosters the most extreme and authoritarian elements of this ideology. Extreme, all disparities in representation are due to oppression, authoritarian, we should discriminate to correct for this oppression. And he goes on to list what he sees as left biases and right biases. Left biases include compassion for the weak, and disparities are due to injustices. Right biases that he cites include respect for the strong and authority, and that disparities are natural and just. And then he's got a bulleted list of personality differences between women and men that he believes are partly accountable for the disparity in number of workers. And he writes, on average, women have a stronger interest in people rather than things, and are more extroverted, agreeable, and he says neurotic. So what do you think of all that? Where do you enter? Its accuracy or its relevance?
I think that the understanding of the memo has really developed over the past week, because when it was first released on Saturday by Gizmodo, we didn't understand that there were a lot of citations. So then on Monday, us at Motherboard released the entire memo with its full citations. And then it kind of came to light that Damore had used a number of scientific studies in which to base his, generalizations about, the two genders. What I think is important to clarify, though, is that a number of those studies from the researchers I have spoke to and feedback I've gotten are not necessarily put in the correct context. I also think it's important to realize that he used one field of research, evolutionary psychology, in order to make those generalizations about the sexes, and there's little that he said about cultural influences that may have, accounted for the disparity. I think that that's really important to clarify, that it's only one lens in which you can look at the problem of diversity or look at the differences between the sexes. A number of sources that I spoke to and a number of people that I've spoken to since the memo came out also acknowledge that it seems to erase the identity of both trans people and LGBTQ people. It only looks at gender from a binary perspective, which I think was offensive to a lot of the readers that I've heard from.
Now, Louise, you've probably seen that The Atlantic, or the writer Connor Friedersdorf on The Atlantic, is critiquing other news outlets for categorizing the memo as anti-diversity. Connor says using that shorthand is misleading. He says, quote, it could have, he writes that the Damore memo could have benefited, quote, greatly from an editor with more emotional intelligence than the author to help him avoid alienating his audience. But says the balance of his memo argues that he is not against pursuing greater gender diversity at Google. He said he is against the current means Google is using to pursue that end, and the way the company conceives of trade-offs between the good of diversity and other goods. I assume you read Connor's article.
I have. I have two responses to that. I think the first is that the first report that we released at Motherboard really early Saturday morning at around 2 a.m. was before we had seen the full contents of the memo, and the way that it was described to us by our sources was anti-diversity. I also stand behind that characterization because it is anti the diversity efforts that, have been used throughout Silicon Valley. I understand why that characterization, now that we have the full context of the memo, might seem confusing, but I think that it still accurately categorizes, some of what was said.
Do you want to add anything to that, Joelle?
Yeah, I think that it's fair to call a memo highlighting biological differences between men and women as affecting sort of who's more innately suited to be an engineer anti-diversity. I think that's a fair characterization, even with what we know now.
So Louise is a journalist, you're a corporate consultant, a diversity consultant, and Damore's firing also hit a nerve in the alt-right, especially. The conservative activists have been all over social media calling his termination from the company disgusting and just another example of liberal political correctness run amok. Their point being that Damore should have been granted the right to express himself, and people should have denounced this memo if they wanted to denounce his memo, but the company shouldn't have fired him. And some other Google employees, at least according to Damore's memo, applauded him for writing these views and admitted to sharing similar thoughts on the matter, but they were too scared to bring it up. So what's your opinion about this aspect and where the line should be?
Yeah, it's not particularly remarkable to say that when people share sexist views at work or racist views at work or in any other way bigoted views at work, that an employer can take action against them. I think the term free speech gets thrown around a whole lot in contexts where it doesn't belong. You actually don't have a right to say any racist or sexist thing that creeps into your head or any kind of share any kind of bigoted ideology that you may hold at work. Employers not only have a right, but they have an obligation to take action when that happens, because it creates an environment that makes it more difficult for other people to be successful at their work. Even just one individual sharing racist ideas, sexist ideas in the workplace can make it really challenging for their peers to show up to that same workplace and be empowered to do their best work, which is sort of one of the reasons we have hostile work environment as a claim that plaintiffs can make in employment law. We know the impact that words can have. So there's never been, or for a very long time, we've never had an understanding that the workplace is somewhere where you can share any ideas that you might have. And I think, you know, firing people for ideas is pretty different than firing people for expressing those problematic ideas at work.
And do you think that this crossed the line into sexism?
Absolutely. I think talking about, you know, kind of stereotyping men and women as having sort of different innate abilities when it comes to engineering skills absolutely crosses the line into sexism. I think it's also counter to sort of the body of research on this particular question. But I think it absolutely crosses the line into sexism. And if you're someone that works on the same team with this person, and you now know that he thinks that you might have really innately less ability to show up every day and do your job, that can make it really challenging for you to be able to be successful or for you to even want to continue to work on projects with that person. So I think it clearly crossed the line. I think, you know, to Google, what Google said is that it actually violated their code of conduct. And I think it would violate many companies' codes of conduct. So I think they handled it, you know, exactly right.
Let's take a phone call. Leanne in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Leanne.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
I'm excited.
Go ahead.
So agree that a memo like this creates a hostile work environment. I am a woman in tech.
Sorry, you actually broke up at a crucial moment there. You're saying you do not agree that this creates a hostile environment?
I do not agree. I don't like some of the contents of it. I don't agree with them. And to be honest, I don't.
Oh boy, we're having
memos like this. But what I will say is, just because, you know, one idiot has an opinion, it doesn't affect me doing my job. It's not about one person's opinion. It's about the company's overall policy.
Joelle, I'm going to go back to you. So yeah. Leanne, are you saying then, if it doesn't create a hostile environment, that you're unhappy that Damore got fired for releasing this memo?
I think that firing him was not the action that would have taken. I think there is a better way to have a productive way of dealing with a problem like this. And I think firing him ended up causing more blowback than actually solving the problem at hand.
Joelle?
Yeah, so I think that's a totally fair point. And I think the fact that we all have different levels of tolerance for different types of behavior is fair, but that's actually not sort of what we consider when asking if something creates a hostile work environment. It's not, did everyone feel personally offended by this, or did everyone think the company should have taken action? It's about how it made a particular individual feel and whether that's reasonable, right? Was this, you know, from a legal context, we ask things like whether behavior was severe or pervasive, but it actually doesn't matter if it was the employer's perspective. Employers have an obligation to protect their employees. So even if an employer believes that, you know, everyone has the capacity to be an engineer, if there's an employee showing up at work saying, hey, women are biologically inferior when it comes to this, employers actually have an obligation to take action whether or not they agree with those views.
I'm not arguing that employers don't have a responsibility to protect their employees. I completely agree with that point, but I will say that I don't agree with the method that was taken. I don't think that is the ultimate best solution to protect the employees, because what it does is it creates even further divide, and it makes people who maybe even if they disagreed with only part of what he was saying, then feel threatened and then also not feel safe.
Thank you for your call, Leanne. We appreciate it. As we continue with Louise Matsakis, assistant editor at Vice Media's Motherboard site, which covers tech, and Joelle Emerson, founder and CEO of Paradigm, a diversity consulting company. Joelle is also a former women's rights lawyer. As we talk about the James Damore memo, he was a Google employee until he got fired for this memo, which was listing reasons that he thinks biological differences and just differences in men and women have something to do with why there are so few women in the tech sector and that Google's diversity efforts are misguided. And Greg in Poughkeepsie, you're on WNYC. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Brian. I'd like to make two points. The first is that I think what he's saying is really being misrepresented. He's not saying women are incapable of working in tech. What he is saying is that on average, when looking at people as a group, not as individuals, but when looking at people as a group, less women are interested in tech, which leads to my next point I would like to make, which is about what's often called the Norwegian gender paradox. Countries that have more egalitarian cultures between the differences between men and women actually see a greater difference in the jobs that men and women choose. And I think this directly contradicts the point that your one guest was making earlier, that this is cultural entirely. I think there are biological factors in play, and there's many, many studies. The worst thing you can say about this memo is that some of the science is debatable. I personally think that most of it is pretty above board. I think that the tone of the memo was not great, but I generally think that he got a lot of things right, and I definitely don't think he should be fired for it, especially when Google is supposed to be a very open company that values diversity, asks its employees to spend part of their time working on solving problems that are not directly related to their day-to-day work. It's very frustrating to hear this talked about as anti-diversity. To even hearing your guests speak, they're talking about how sexism is unacceptable, misogyny is all these things, assuming that all these things he said are this and reinforcing that idea. It's ridiculous. I this is why we can't have conversations about things in this country. It's preposterous. It's why we elected this clown, because people can't talk to each other. It's mind-boggling.
Louise, how are you reacting to Greg?
I think what's important to realize is whether the mischaracterization of what he said is, you know, one thing that I'm going to kind of put aside for a moment, but I think that perhaps he mischaracterized the skills needed in order to do coding and to be an engineer. I think that's what's important to look at, is that some of the skills that he says are kind of not useful to coding or that would make women less interested in coding. From the engineers that I've spoken to, I think that that's a fundamental misconception about what it means to be a software engineer. I think that collaboration, empathy, high verbal reasoning, I think some of the skills that he attributed to being higher in women are actually, you know, more useful to being a, you know, good, you know, a successful software engineer. So I think that that's kind of what's important to look at, is that being a good software engineer is kind of associated with some of the things that on these studies that he refers to actually women are better at, which makes me wonder about whether or not citing biology as the problem in tech is really accurate.
Do you, as somebody who, covers, I presume you cover Google in other ways to some degree, were you surprised that they fired him? I mean, one characterization I've seen about Google in general is that they value a culture of argument in developing the best, you know, kinds of products, that they value a lot of back and forth and people shooting down other people's ideas. I presume they want it to be done in a respectful way. But a certain kind of culture of disagreement at Google is considered, creatively dynamic. Are you surprised, given that, or given anything else, that Google fired him for this?
I think your characterization of Google is accurate. One of the things that surprised me in this reporting was the sheer number of discussion platforms that Google employees have available to them. There are dozens of different, you know, communication methods in which Google employees can talk to each other and discuss these issues. One of the reasons that this memo was distributed at all is that these channels are available. I'm not surprised that they fired him, and I think that that says less about Google as a company or Google's ideological stance and more about a general HR decision. What was the other remedies here? To switch his team, to switch his manager, to switch other people on his team? I think that those were trickier and more complicated decisions rather than then deciding to remove him from the workplace. I think thinking about this in terms of Google exclusively is perhaps misguided. It's more to think about what would any HR do.
And Greg, to go back to the memo, which it sounds like you read, it struck me as not so much suggestions for improving the gender balance in the workplace as opposed to suggestions for, well, a critique of the diversity program. You know, so he said he's not against diversity and he is certainly not for sexism, is the way he framed the memo. But then when you get to the suggestions portion, they all have to do with problems that he sees with Google's diversity operation, not with enough women, not enough women in the workplace. His own categories here, his suggestions, demoralize diversity. As soon as we start to moralize an issue, we stop thinking about it in terms of costs and benefits. Stop alienating conservatives. Confront Google's biases. Stop restricting programs and classes to certain genders or races, and have an open and honest discussion about the costs and benefits of our diversity programs. So it doesn't strike me from that he's looking for ways to increase the gender diversity of Google as much as to get Google to stop trying, at least with its current methods, to increase diversity.
Well, I think he thinks that the gender training causes a lot of backlash, and he might be the perfect example of that because he started writing this after he attended a diversity training. And again, he cited studies that show that there isn't a lot of science backing up the fact that the idea that this diversity training actually changes people. And as a matter of fact, there's, you know, some studies showing that people find it, you know, condescending. You know, if you become an adult and you need to be told certain things at a certain point, it's patronizing. As for his suggestions, what for me, reading it was very frustrating because I felt he was not doing a good job making certain arguments, which is really frustrating. The idea that I get from him is it seemed to me he was looking to create teams of people to, you know, leverage their diversity. So you got a lot of people with different, different backgrounds on one team and, you know, make the company work better like that, get more perspectives.
Right.
I think that's more where he was coming from by bringing up these differences, saying that we need to look at this. Maybe we can use this to our advantage. Some of his recommendations were not great. But I also think that, you know, saying only certain people can attend certain classes or are available to certain types of mentoring. Okay, I understand that certain people have been, you know, traditionally disadvantaged, but that's exclusionary, and that's, you know, two wrongs don't make a right. That's not good either, right? You know, and that's going to create backlash, whether it's wrong or right.
Greg, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. So, Joelle, for you as a diversity consultant, how do you react to some of that? And sort of, in addition to his specifics, his underlying notion there that he also attributes to James Damore, that there's going to be less buy-in on the part, especially of conservatives, or he does say conservatives in particular in the memo, but less buy-in and risk creating a backlash to the diversity efforts, which may not ultimately serve the cause of diversity.
It's a great point, and it's something that does happen a lot. I think, you know, not everyone in companies has spent quite as much time thinking about diversity and inclusion as I have, and I think, and as, you know, HR people have. And I think it's not a great approach to talk about these things in condescending ways or to lecture people. I think anytime we train people by giving them a laundry list of things not to do, that tends to backfire. So I think the point is really well taken. I think instead we do need to have more conversations. We need to find ways to engage people across difference, because the barriers that actually perpetuate these homogenous cultures and keep people out are not things that come from conservatives uniquely or even from men uniquely. A lot of these barriers, factors like implicit bias, are things that we all share, and that by finding strategies to manage, we're not only going to make more diverse and inclusive organizations, we're just going to make better, more objective, more data-driven decisions. So I think there are ways to engage in this conversation that that bring most people along and that, you know, avoid some of that backlash, some of that defensiveness, that alienation. On the other hand, I think there are, you know, a percentage of folks, and I think it's a small percentage, but there are a percentage of folks within most organizations who are so resistant to these ideas that any conversation is going to be difficult, and that they're going to be kind of detractors no matter what the organization tries to do. And what I sometimes see is that organizations spend so much time focused on those 10% and trying to bring them along that they actually miss the strategies that are going to be most helpful for the other 90% and for really engaging people that aren't totally opposed to inclusion and diversity, that just haven't thought about it or don't know a ton about it. So I think, you know, the general point around backlash is a good one, but I also don't think efforts should be catered to the most resistant. I think we should really think about where are the majority of folks on these topics and how do we communicate with them most effectively to get people engaged and to get people to respond positively.
Louise, I'll give you the last word. Where do you think Google's diversity efforts fit in the larger scheme of the tech sector, and how serious they are about trying things that work or things that don't work, but really actually trying to increase the percentage of women on their staffs?
I think what's important to think about when you look at the Google case, and one of the reasons that we felt like this memo was newsworthy, is that Google is currently under investigation from the Department of Labor for what two agency representatives said were a severe gender pay gap between men and women. And I think that's important context. And I think that there are problems like that throughout the Valley. I do think that diversity is going to continue to be a conversation that, you know, we have to realize that a lot of these companies were built by white men. And what are they going to look like, you know, in an era where people want more inclusion and where that becomes a central issue?
Louise Matsakis, assistant editor at Vice's Motherboard. And Joelle Emerson, founder and CEO of Paradigm, a diversity consulting company. She was a women's rights lawyer previously. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.